January is a changing of the guard in public office. And here in the greater KC Metro, two cities have caught our attention.
I move that we elect Mr. Jermaine Wilson as mayor of Leavenworth.
There's a new mayor in Leavenworth, Jermaine Wilson. And when he changed seats with the outgoing mayor in kind of a passing of the torch type ceremony on January 8th, it did not happen quietly, like city bureaucracy usually does.
Aye.
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 Passes 5-0. Congratulations.
Tons of people from the community were there to witness this moment. They were raising the roof, clapping, taking video. It's a big deal because of the new mayor's personal story. When he was 19, he was convicted of a felony. In some states, there's controversy surrounding just the restoration of a convicted felon's right to vote, let alone seek office. But in Leavenworth, Kansas, not only did Jermaine Wilson get a new start, he has turned himself into the leader of his city. I'm Gina Kaufman. Jermaine Wilson, good morning and welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Hey, welcome, welcome. It's great to be, it's exciting to be here. Exciting.
What was it like to relive that moment just now? I mean, in the scene as it actually played out on January 8th, when you took the mic, the first thing you said was, I wasn't going to cry.
Yes, ma'am. I was just thankful just to be able to be in that position because it's like I'm living in a dream. And I know God gave me another chance and to see that the people gave me another chance. I was just overwhelmed with unexplainable joy.
So take me back. I mean, let's go through your personal story a little bit and we'll get back to kind of what you hope to do as mayor.
Yes, ma'am.
I want to start with that moment when you're 19. I mean, that's the first real turning point in your story. And, you know, you grew up in Leavenworth, right?
Yes, ma'am. Correct.
What happened when you were a teenager?
Well, when I was a teenager, I was raised with both parents. I looked up to my big brother, and I wanted to fit in with the in crowd. So therefore, I started doing what everybody else was doing, getting in drugs, ripping and running the streets, getting in fights, kicked out of school, ran away from home. And I was incarcerated at 15. And while I was incarcerated, I tried to escape from juvie, and I was sentenced to an additional 2 years. So now I'm 15 years old on my way to go serve 4 years in a juvenile detention facility. Got involved in gangs, wanted to fit in, was searching just for a group to accept me because I didn't understand who I was created to be. I didn't have an identity for myself.
Can you walk me through that a little more slowly? Just because, you know, when I hear, you know, I got involved in gangs.
Yeah.
I don't know what that feels like or looks like how that sort of decision gets made, if that makes sense?
Well, yes, the most challenging part is when you go to a placement, you don't know people, and you feel like you're all alone, so therefore you try to fit in.
In the juvenile court system?
Correct, correct. And so when I went to my placement, which was in Atchison, the first place, I searched for that group that was the most dominant, and, you know, they seen me, they accepted me, they embraced me, and, you know, to fit in and get involved inside of this gang, you know, I had to get in fights a lot, prove that I could do the things that, you know, that the gangs wanted you to do.
So just like the way that if you were in a high school environment, you might want to, like, make a team or something.
Correct. It was just a bad experience. And at that time, you know, you don't think about it. You just have in your mindset that I'm willing to do whatever it takes so I can be accepted.
Can you talk to me about the Leavenworth you grew up in? Because I mean, yeah, we all hear about the prison in Leavenworth. So it's sort of interesting. But what was it like growing up there?
Well, I actually grew up in Woodland Village at the time. It was Valley View government housing, and that was my environment. You know, there was a lot of gangs taking place, drugs in the area, and it's a very diverse community. We got the military community, the prison community, and, you know, growing up, I seen a lot of crime, and just in my area, those were the things that I was exposed to, because after a period of time seeing it so much, it becomes normal, and that's exactly what I was exposed to. But Leavenworth is definitely a very diverse community. You know, you got blacks, whites, just different races. And, you know, at the time I seen that it's a group over here and it's a group over here. And the thing that got me, you know, I didn't understand or didn't know where I belong, which group that I belong to. And so therefore, I just started hanging out with the group that I felt the most comfortable with.
Why do you think you felt the most comfortable with them?
Because it was I was exposed to it day in and day out and became normal, you know the saying, you become a product to your environment. And that that environment that I was exposed to, that's what I became accustomed to the most of.
You talked about that maybe your brother was sort of like your role model in some
yes,
of
ma'am.
This. Did it feel like maybe like an imitation kind of thing that you were following this path because it's just what you saw?
Yes, ma'am. And to me, like I said, he was my big brother. He was my hero. He protected me. You know, he taught me a lot of things. Some was good and some was bad. And, you know, he was getting locked up in and out constantly. And I felt like, you know, I had to fulfill this role and try to uphold that image that he once had. So therefore, I was trying to do any and everything just so I could emulate him and I can get the respect that he once had.
That's, you know, I think a lot of people with older siblings do that in whatever area, like whatever their older brother or sister is really good at. You feel like you're stepping into these big shoes to fill.
Yes.
Is there something from your brother's like leadership that you do still look back on and think this is a positive for me, something good that I learned? Or because it sounds like he led you down a really difficult and challenging path. But what else did he model? Because you've talked about some of it was good.
Well, he had a strong will and a desire. Anytime that he put his mind to something, he was going to do it no matter what. And I seen that he just had that passion, that desire to go nonstop. Because the most powerful thing to have in this world is a made up mind. And my brother, he did that. And because like I said, he worked on cars, bicycles. And it's just that, you know, his ability to go and not stop until he's accomplished that goal, you know, that always stuck with me no matter what.
You talked about that you grew up in a household with two parents. Can you tell me more about the larger household you come from?
Yes, at the time before the second generation of kids came about, it was four of us. And, you know, my mom, she worked two jobs. My dad, he was on disability. And so we had a lot of free time. Whenever we went in church, which was seemed as if 24/7, you know, we would go back at home. And I just became rebellious at church. You know, my parents, they did the best that they could. And, you know, when you think in church is just the only answer, you know, it wasn't for a 10-year-old. It was difficult. You know, I became rebellious toward the church because we were forced to go. And whenever I got that free time, you know, I started running away, getting involved off in drugs.
Well, so what happened when you were 19?
When I was 19, I was just released from juvenile after serving 4 years. You know, I went back to my old neighborhood, my old so-called friends, and at that time it was a crack epidemic throughout Leavenworth, Kansas.
What year are we talking about?
This was in 2006.
Okay.
Yeah, 2006. April 2006 to be exactly. And, you know, when I went back to my old neighborhood, it was a crack epidemic, and everybody that I knew, you know, was either getting high or they were selling drugs. And I seen how they were all making money. And, you know, I was required on probation to get a job. So I figured if I just started making money, I could lie to my PO and tell her that I got a job.
So how'd that go?
Well, it didn't go well at all. and you know, because once I started selling drugs and, you know, I got involved off into it, I became consumed. I started taking drugs. And, you know, I had lost my identity, stopped reporting to my PO, started getting dirty UAs. And I was just headed down the path of destruction.
Did you at any point during that time before your arrest, which we'll get to, did you at any point think this is not good?
Yes. After I want to say maybe a year of actually just indulging off into that lifestyle, I became tired, you know, exhausted, wanting to quit, just not knowing how to quit because so many people around me was constantly doing it. And by now, you know, everybody was dependent on me and looking up to me as the leader.
Can you explain that a little more?
Yes. You know, once you start getting money, of course, you start getting power, then you get influence, and now everybody's leaning on you. So whenever I would say something, people will respond to what I would say. And, you know, at this time, I'm young, immature, still a 15-year-old, you know, just 19 at this time. time and not knowing how to really delegate in a positive way, knowing that I have the leadership qualities and people are looking up to me, I'm leading them down the wrong way instead of a positive way.
Well, and power, I think, you know, there's lots of evidence that that's intoxicating for people much older than 19.
Yes, ma'am, that it is.
So what happened that eventually led to your arrest?
Well, the officers, they knew me by this time. They recognized my vehicle. You know, they had plans on catching me eventually, and I knew it was going to happen one day. And one particular day, they followed me. They see my vehicle. They knew I was driving. They left the house calling. They followed me all the way down on 4th Street, Leavenworth, Kansas, pulled me over. My license was suspended at the time, and when they pulled me out, they smelled marijuana, gave them probable cause to search the vehicle, and that's when they found drugs.
So what happened from there?
Well, I was arrested. I was sitting in county jail thinking that I was going to get probation simply because it was my first adult case and it was a drug charge. And, you know, according to the laws, you know, as an adult, if you get your first drug offense, you're eligible for the Senate Bill 123. So I bonded out. You know, I started dropping UAs thinking that I'm going to get probation down the long run. But
that's urine analysis?
Ma'am?
Is that urine analysis?
Yes, ma'am.
UAs? Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. And you know, I didn't quit hustling. And so I'm thinking that I'm expecting to get something good out of return, but I'm continuing dozing off into this lifestyle, and which led to that time of me being out on bond. 6 months after that, I started going to court and they told me that I'm not going to get probation. You're going to prison.
So prison is really it's where a big transformation happened for you.
Correct. Yes, ma'am.
Can you describe what happened to you in prison? Because it's such a different story from what happened to you when you were surrounded by friends and surrounded by, yeah, like it just sounds like being alone was this whole revelation for you.
Yes, ma'am. So while I was actually in prison, I sobered up. My mind got clear. I started to focus on the things that really mattered. My son was 8 months old, and, you know, I had neglected my responsibilities. So sitting in that prison cell, the only thing that I had was my Bible. And, you know, I'm surrounded by, you know, thieves, killers, rapists, and a lot of them have life in prison. And I'm just like, you know what? I don't know, God, what it is that you have for me, but I don't want to spend the rest of my life in prison or dead in a casket. And I knew if I didn't change, those were the only two options. I wanted something different out of life. And that's when I cried out to God. I'm like, God, if you're real, speak to my heart, change my heart, forgive me of my sins. And all of those things that my mother taught me and those things that I learned while I was in church, that start coming back to my memory, knowing that Jesus does forgive those who sin and cry out and ask him for forgiveness.
Did you, while you were kind of going through this Bible study, like very solo Bible study, it sounds like, and really personal soul searching, what were your thoughts about what you had been doing?
Well, I knew that I had made a lot of mistakes in my life, and I knew that I had caused a lot of harm to people. And when I had that time to reflect, and, you know, I knew that I could never go back and change the hands of time, but I knew I could be productive and make a difference by moving forward. And I wanted that. I didn't want to hurt anybody else. I had made that commitment to God. If you give me another chance to be with my family and have freedom and me be able to walk out of prison, you know, without any harm, you know, I will do whatever it takes to impact, build up my community and serve people.
So what did you have to do to make that possible from a logistical standpoint, from a spiritual standpoint? That's in your hands. But from a like legal and like career building standpoint, there are a lot of hoops to jump through. Can you describe the process from having a personal revelation to clearing your own path for?
Well, yes, ma'am. I actually started studying. I started reading self-help books, taking leadership courses, even some college courses, enhancing my vocabulary, started bettering myself as a person, start coming up with business plans on things that I wanted to accomplish once I got released from prison. And, you know, I was preparing myself for where I wanted to go because I knew that with the influence and just the ability to be able to communicate well with people, I knew that I was going to be successful. I just had to continue to study, prepare myself every single day, knowing that one day I was going to be free. And when that time came for me to be free, I was able to apply everything that I had learned while I was in prison.
You eventually expunged your own criminal record. Can you explain what that entailed?
Yes, ma'am. Well, if you're eligible, your eligibility date starts once you've completed your supervision. So I was eligible to get my record expunged 3 years after I completed my parole. When that opportunity came, I looked it up and it says that I was eligible to get my record expunged. I received my income taxes, saved my income taxes. And when that time came for me, I contacted a lawyer and the lawyer told me it was $500 and $190 filing fee. So a total rounded up about $700. So when that time came, I gave him the money. He took it to court. It was a 3-week process, submitted it. The judge did not object to it. And I actually received a letter in the mail confirming that my record was expunged.
And that is what has made it possible for you to be in city government, right?
Well, yes, ma'am. It was a weight lifted off of my shoulders. But with the state of Kansas, you're eligible to run for office if you completed your probation or parole. So you have the right to vote. It just was a release for me because I knew that I didn't have to have anything holding me back. I knew that people would still try to bring up my past. But for me, I knew that it was something that I accomplished and I knew that God had given me a new start. And I didn't have to expose my criminal record to anyone because legally I have the right to say that I haven't been convicted of a felon because my record's expunged.
And yet you do talk about it.
Yes, ma'am, because I want people to know, you know, just because you made a mistake, your past mistakes doesn't define who you are. Identifying your mistakes that you make helps you to understand who you are, and you're able to move forward once you accept the mistakes that you made. People will hold you back, but don't allow people to stop you from the progress that you can make and the changes that you can make.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll get right back to the story of Jermaine Wilson, the new mayor of Leavenworth, who famously turned his life around after doing time for a felony conviction. We'll hear more after this break on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Jermaine Wilson, new mayor of Leavenworth, welcome back.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
We were just talking about your sort of transformation, like turning your life around both in prison and then once you left, like going forth with expunging your criminal record and eventually running for office in Leavenworth, starting with city commissioner. But I want to backtrack a little bit.
Yes, ma'am.
Because you didn't run for office the second you got out of prison. You actually started with other kinds of work in your community.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you take me back to the moment where you're a free man again for the first time in years? And you're thinking, what am I going to do? Can you take me through that thought process and help me understand where your life was?
Well, yes, ma'am. One goal that I had set for myself while I was incarcerated, I said, as soon as I get released, I'm going to tell everybody my story because I don't want people to make the same mistakes that I made. So as soon as I got out, I found a church home, was able to parole to my son's mother's house. We got married, joined the church. My beautiful wife, Jessica Wilson, we found a church home. And then I started sharing my story inside the churches throughout the Leavenworth area, Kansas City area. And, you know, after I completed my first year of parole, I got off on early release because of good behavior. And immediately my second goal that I said I wanted to do, I wanted to go back inside of that same prison where I served time at. And when that opportunity came, I became a mentor in Lansing Correctional Facility. I started sharing my testimony, helping inmates, you know, write resumes, business plans. And, you know, the same thing that I had learned while I was incarcerated, I started giving back to them and letting them know that you can succeed, but it's going to take dedication, determination, and discipline. And so as I began to continue to mentor with them, I just started to continue to go back inside of that same juvenile facility where I tried to escape from. That door opened up and I started, you know, talking to the youth, teaching
them. You're talking to young Jermaines, basically.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Because I don't want them to go where I had been. And I know that if you can stop them now at an early age and you can prevent them from going to prison.
What does that take other than a mentor?
Well, you have to just be truthful with the youth. The youth want someone who's going to listen to them. And before I started telling my story, just going at them with them and letting them know what I've been through, I listen to them and I hear where they come from. And so as they're opening up and they see that a person is taking time and listening to them, you're building trust with them. Now that the trust is built, now when I open up my mouth and speak to them, they're opened up to receive the message that I have for them.
When you made the decision to pursue a career in politics. Was that because there was something that you felt you could do in that arena that you couldn't do just face to face with individual kids?
No, ma'am. Politics was definitely never on my radar. I'd never had a desire to get off into politics. We actually had started a nonprofit organization called Unity in the Community Movement, where we were actually mentoring the youth, serving the homeless community, and building a community relationship with our local law enforcement. We wanted to bring our community together so we all could move this community forward, because our community got great potential. It was just so much corruption that was taking place throughout society. With all these different movements that was being established, Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, all these different organizations. And I felt like there needed to be an organization that's going to unify people, because it's going to take all of us coming together, doing our part in order for change to really take place, not just in our community, but throughout the world. But I knew if we start at home, we'll be able to impact outside of our community eventually.
So it actually sounds like you find it's interesting to me that someone who sounds like such an activist in so many ways,
yes, ma'am,
is sort of put off by activist movements.
Correct. Yes, ma'am. And I knew once you start serving people, eventually God was going to open so many other doors. And
but what is it that puts you off about activist movements?
You said put me off?
Yeah, just that you find sort of it sounds like you find the you referenced Black Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter, for example, like. What is it that you find unproductive, I guess, about groups like that?
Well, it's not unproductive. I just think it causes so much division, because the thing is, how many of those groups you see actually unifying, coming together? You know, each one of us going to have different opinions no matter what. But let's come together and agree on common ground so we can benefit collectively overall. And, you know, once you work together, you'll have a larger impact than just one person doing this. There's one body. Many parts. But if the parts never come together and attach to that one body, how effective are we really? You're doing a piece over here, I'm doing a piece over here, but we can do a lot more if we come together. And that was my main goal.
So how can you take me through a success that you had in doing that? Because what you're talking about, I think a lot of people agree, you know, yes, we need more unity. But then when you get into the nitty gritty of it, when people are disagreeing very deeply and very passionately, how do you do it?
Well, you have to bring people together. And I know sometimes it's a challenge simply because people may be afraid to communicate with people because they don't look like each other. They may not believe the same way. But you got to find that common ground that people can agree upon. At the time, we wanted peace in our community. We didn't want the blacks or whites, to be afraid of local law enforcement. Now, you have a person, you know, who's on the other side of the fence, who was against local law enforcement because of the lifestyle that I was living. To see an individual come, you know, to try to unite, bring that peace, work with our local law enforcement, and people know me from my past, and to see me working with our local law enforcement, it got to be something different. And when they see that, they like, well, if Jermaine's working with them, they can't be that bad. So to be able to come on one platform, we're working together. We had the youth versus the police department in basketball. And that was one of our biggest unity in the community events. When people seen us working with our local law enforcement, they were excited. They were joyous. And they just like, you know what? They are good people. We are making a difference. They're here to help us. And that's the message that we really tried to send out.
So when did politics really enter your horizon? When did you start thinking about maybe I'm going to run for office?
Well, after I was serving the community over a period of time, I had a good friend named Sean Crittenton. He had spoke to me, said, the way you're blessing and serving the community, you could possibly become the mayor one day at Leavenworth, Kansas. This was in 2014. And I said,
you have the biggest smile on your face right now.
Well, I got a lot to be thankful for, ma'am. And I'm just, that's my trademark. I'm short and I got a beautiful smile.
Go on.
Yes, ma'am. And so when he had told me, he said, you're going to have an influence and, you know, possibly you can become the mayor. I said, yeah, right. I didn't believe him. And, you know, as I said, that God spoke to my heart and said, why not? And I called my wife and told her what he had said. And she had said, well, possibly you can be one day. So when she said it to me, it gave me confidence. And I just prayed about it. And, you know, I didn't really act on it. I just knew that God had greater things for me in store. So to fast forward, 2017, so many people in the community just said, hey, look, hey, we think that you'll be a great city commissioner. And I said, I don't know nothing about politics. They said, but you got the number one thing down. You love to serve people. When that time came, I said, God, if it's you, I put my name in a hat. I said, you'll open this door. And when that time came, I came in first place with the most votes.
So what has sort of, what have you learned in your time in this other realm, in this political realm? What have you witnessed about how the city that you came up in, like how it worked, that maybe has inspired you to pursue change on a political level?
Well, first off, politics is very slow. and there's so much. From the outside looking in, one thing that you think that it could just happen overnight. Well, change doesn't happen overnight. It's a process. It gives you time to understand how the city works. You get to really understand everybody in your community have problems. Their problems may not be your problems, but to be able to help create the solution to that problem as a commission together collectively, man, it's been a great joy simply because it's very much needed. And to be able to fulfill a request of a citizen, you know, that's that moment is priceless. To see a smile on a citizen's face who didn't think they had a voice, didn't think that they had no one who cared or was concerned about their issues, to be able to fulfill that, you know, it brings them joy. And it's just peace to my heart knowing that I'm doing what I was called to do.
What are some of your goals now that you're mayor?
Well, continue to bring hope to the community, be a voice for those who feel voiceless, to be able to connect with those citizens who feel as if they're forced to live in those conditions. You know, we're working on this program right now, the Landlord and Tenant Conflict Resolution Program. And it's those tenants who don't have the funds to be able to move out of the house. If a landlord refuses to fix anything, that's when the tenant can actually contact the city, and then the city can, you know, make the landlord do what he's supposed to do. If not, then it's when that landlord could possibly lose his license. It's not set in stone yet, but that's something that we're trying to work on. And that just covers the area of being a voice for the voiceless, giving hope to those who feel like they don't have hope in their community.
Is there another project that you're sort of hoping to get off the ground, or is that sort of the pet one?
Well, that's the biggest one because it's going to take a lot. It's going to take the commission coming together moving forward to bring in those family businesses because those we're lacking so many different amenities in our community. It's a great community, a great place to raise your family. But to be able to get a power play, that'd be so exciting on the weekend. You know, we can do stuff and have fun in our community. We won't have to go outside of our community. I think that'd be a great thing, and especially for the youth.
Jermaine Wilson, congratulations on everything you've achieved, and we'll be watching what's going on in Leavenworth with you as mayor.
Thank you, ma'am. I greatly appreciate it.
Jermaine Wilson became mayor of Leavenworth on January 8th. I'm Gina Kaufman. When we return, the outgoing mayor of Prairie Village looks back on change she's witnessed in that community in her years running the show as mayor. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And with January being kind of a changing of the guard in public office, we wanted to tell the stories of a couple of communities seeing significant change beyond leadership, but also the mayors who represent that change. We just heard the story of what a new mayor hopes to do in Leavenworth. Let's talk now about Prairie Village. We're here with a community talking about a community that's changed a lot. And the mayor who's been at the helm for that transition is Laura Wassmer. Her term ended January 14th, and now she's here with me in the studio to look back on it all. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Gina.
I know that you are most proud of the Meadowbrook development, and we will get to that. But I think what's really put Prairie Village in the public eye lately is, well, two things, the anti-discrimination ordinance and the controversy around tear down, rebuild, that whole trend in real estate with very large houses being built on lots that were previously home to small houses.
Exactly.
Can we talk about those things and what they say about how Prairie Village is changing right now in general? Let's start with the anti-discrimination ordinance.
Sure. Well, first of all, I think it's unfortunate that issue hasn't been dealt with at the federal level. Or even the state level, the LGBTQ, the fact that we're still having to deal with equal rights. I mean, it just seems like it's a no-brainer.
Because the deal is that protections as an employee from discrimination based on sexual orientation or as some in the housing realm.
Right.
Those are not guaranteed at the federal level.
Exactly. And ideally, that's where these topics should be addressed so that each individual city does not have to go through what we just went through. It's a very expensive thing to have to do to, you know, hire our individual lawyers to craft ordinances for our cities. And yet it's obviously the right thing to do. So I'm very excited that we did that. I'm glad that we had a unanimous decision to do that. Again, I think it was absolutely the right thing to do. And I know many other cities are also looking at that. Roland Park passed that before we did. So we started with their ordinance and then made some adjustments to that. And I know other cities are going to be able to use our ordinance. So
it was a long process. And it sounds like kind of there was a lot of tension around what someone described as doing it right, making sure you got this right.
Right, exactly. And I think the reason for that is we didn't want this just to be a feel-good measure. We wanted it to be something that we could actually enforce. And we had to look at what resources we actually had available within our city, our staff, to be able to enforce something like this. So we didn't want to craft something that was something that just sounded good. We wanted it to really have some teeth to it, and we wanted it to be something that we could actually enforce.
What are the teeth?
So basically, we are going to be taking it through our municipal court. So we will have our prosecutor and our judges taking a look at it. There are fines up to $1,000.
What can people be fined for?
So any kind of discrimination in terms of employment that, you know, an individual feels that they have been fired specifically because of, you know, their identity or their gender. Same thing with housing. So it's really looking at the fairness in both of those and providing some protections.
So then the other sort of big headline, something that people were talking about beyond Prairie Village, is this whole tear down, rebuild thing. Because I don't know if it's gotten so much attention, in part because just driving through Prairie Village, even if you don't live there, it's something that is so striking visually.
Exactly.
You see small houses on lots that feel sort of like proportionate to those houses. And then there will be a house that is filling its lot entirely. And that has caused a lot of tension within Prairie Village. But what's actually happening there?
Well, it's actually a good problem to have. I mean, the fact that people want to move into Prairie Village, reinvest that kind of money into Prairie Village is a good thing. And it's very healthy for the community in the long run. The challenge, as you just mentioned, is finding that balance between acknowledging the rights of the current property owners and not destroying the charm of the community while still allowing that reinvestment to happen. So it took us about 3 years to put two different phases of housing guidelines in place that try to cap that building. We worked on the height and the width, the amount of green space, the amount of the total lot that can be developed, and then some very basic architectural guidelines to help with the massing of the structure. So we want that redevelopment. We just want it to be done appropriately and with respect for what is already there.
Does this represent some kind of larger transformation, either in demographics or in just the sense of in Prairie Village, this is who we are, this is what we do, this is what our personality is. Is there that kind of a transition happening?
I don't think so. I think you're actually seeing this across the United States. I think it's more of location. You know, we're very blessed to be in a very centrally convenient location. You're 10 minutes from the plaza and crossroads, and you're 10 minutes from shopping out at town center. So it's not just our community. Fairway's been dealing with this. Westwood is dealing with this. Roland Park is starting to deal with its mission. So I think it's just the fact that we are conveniently located to a new bustling downtown and crossroads, and people are wanting to still live in Johnson County, where they have the benefit of the excellent quality of life and excellent schools, and yet they still want the convenience of being located close to a larger city. What that means is, looking at the current housing stock, which was built in the 1950s, you know, many of those houses aren't meeting the needs of what the families are looking for today.
So it sounds like what's changed is not so much Prairie Village. What's changed about Prairie Village, as I'm hearing you put it, is actually that downtown has changed.
I believe that is what's happening, again, all over the United States. When you see that, you see this resurgence in downtown development, redevelopment everywhere. You hear about Pittsburgh and Boise, and, you know, lots of communities are going through the same thing that we're going through. So I don't think this is unique to Prairie Village. I do think Prairie Village is a community that has a lot of things going for it. It's a sum of its parts. It's, you know, the fact that we were originally planned it to be a very walkable community, centrally located around our various shopping centers, the fact that we've got beautiful statuary and a lot of parks and beautiful tree-lined streets. All of that has definitely added to people wanting to live in Prairie Village. But I do think it's the redevelopment of the crossroads in the downtown that has made that even more attractive.
So then there's also the change that you have alerted us that you're really excited about. When you look back on your time as mayor, you are most excited about what? Because we've just heard, like, an anti-discrimination ordinance. That is a huge achievement. That's a big deal. You're really, really proud of
parks. That has truly been my passion. I was chair of our Park and Recreation Department in Prairie Village for several years and had the pleasure of implementing our Parks Master Plan over the course of many years. The Meadowbrook opportunity came up while I was still on the Park and Rec Department and right before I became mayor. And what happened with that, so, you know, the former golf course, 134 beautiful acres, trees, you know, rolling hills.
This is at what, 95th and Knoll?
91st. Yeah,
and
Somerset. And the golf course sold, and Van Trust, the developers, ended up purchasing that. And they had the ability, per the existing zoning, to completely develop that entire property into single-family homes. That's what it was zoned for. And they didn't have to come to the city for any permission. They could have just, you know, totally done that. And to their credit, they came to the city, and they originally had an idea of having large estate homes and then carving out about 30 acres for a community park. And they asked us if we would be interested in buying that. And I saw an opportunity, of course, again, as chair of Park and Recreation, here was this beautiful piece of land, and I suggested perhaps turning that around and having the majority of that be parkland with a smaller, denser development. So they took that back to the drawing board and came back with basically the Meadowbrook development idea, which has just been fantastic.
So for people who haven't followed this and aren't super familiar with the area, can you describe what that is?
Sure. So the end result is an 82-acre park, and the remainder of it has been turned into apartments, townhomes, single family, and then there's going to be senior living along with a small boutique hotel. So we did a denser development on the south side of that property, and then the 82 acres, Prairie Village bought that, and then we immediately turned that over to Johnson County. We deeded it to them so that they can manage that long term. So it's actually become a county park.
Why are you so excited about that?
I'm so excited because we just brought in 82 acres of parkland into Prairie Village, which doubles the number of acres that we previously had. And what originally was a private amenity is now a community amenity, not only for Prairie Village, but for really anybody in the area.
So formerly a country club for members, now parkland for anyone.
Exactly. And what it could have been, too. The fact that it could have been all single-family lots, and instead 82 acres has been preserved for the community as a whole.
As an outgoing mayor, that must seem like something that changes Prairie Village for the better. Can you explain why?
Oh, absolutely. I think anytime you have open green space that anyone can use, that's a benefit. There's going to be 4 miles of walking trails. There's an activity center, beautiful playground equipment, shelters. There's a sledding hill that kids are already using with all the snow. So it's just really fun.
It's interesting because I just don't think of Prairie Village as a place that has been lacking in green space. Am I wrong?
No, I think we've been very lucky that we have, 10, 11 parks. I think now we've just added our 12th. So we do have a lot of green space in Prairie Village, but we didn't have anything of this magnitude.
When you, if you're like, out of town, not just in another part of the metro outside of Prairie Village, but you're out of town in a place where nobody has heard of Prairie Village. How do you describe this community, what it is, what it stands for, what characterizes it?
You know, it's very interesting. We have a sister city with Ukraine, and we had some Ukrainian visitors come stay with us, and they describe Prairie Village as a city within a park. And I think that describes us perfectly, especially now with Meadowbrook and adding North Park, the northern park in our city at 67th and Row. So I think just if you see an overhead photo of Prairie Village, the trees, the green, it just makes for a really beautiful community that people want to be in.
The shopping center that is that people refer to as Prairie Village. Like some people, when they say I'm going to Prairie Village, they might be referring to the whole city, but some people might be referring to a specific shopping center.
Village shopping center,
yes. And that isn't that sort of like retail center within your community
that
has also changed a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. You know, we had a big redevelopment project with both of the shopping centers many years ago that I think was a huge positive for the city. Corinth definitely was in the need of a major facelift. I remember the days when those parking lots were basically empty, and now they're so packed that you can barely find a parking place. So the redevelopment of the centers has been a very good thing for Prairie Village. We do have outside ownership, which has caused some growing pains. They've raised rents fairly significantly, and it's hurt some of our original local owners. So that has been a change, and I know that's been difficult for a lot of people to accept.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, I think, you know, we had some long-term retailers that had been there for quite some time. Spangler's, Bruce Smith,
Tiffany Town.
The Tiffany Town. You know, those shops that we really came to love and view as family. And when when First Washington came in and purchased the centers, they're very much bottom-line driven. And they have to meet their profit goals for their investors, and they felt like our market rents were not at market rate. So they proceeded to increase those rents to what they say is, similar to other shopping centers within the metro. And when we've done our exploration, we found that's true. But it did make it very difficult for some of those mom and pop shops to survive.
So it sounds like this in some ways is just the retail version of the problem that we discussed earlier with that conflict over the tear down rebuild and what's that middle ground of welcoming the reinvestment.
Exactly.
And preserving the identity that people have associated with Prairie Village for a long time. What are your thoughts about that larger question?
You know, it all comes down to property rights. There's not a whole lot that the city can do, unfortunately. First Washington, I think, is going to have to figure out what works for them. And if people no longer shop in the Village Shops, or if they have a large vacancy issue, you know, I think they're going to change their business strategy. Currently, they are not having a hard time filling those spaces with other tenants who want to be in Prairie Village. So there's not a huge incentive for them to, keep some of those small individual-owned stores.
But for you, I guess when I say the bigger question, I mean this bigger question of a changing Prairie Village and a changing outside interest in Prairie Village.
I think, again, there's not a lot we can do. We try to work with the shop owners as much as we possibly can. We try to work with First Washington as much as we can and express, you know, our views and what we would like to see happen in those centers. But at the end of the day, it's their property.
Forgetting about the conflict about retailers, just as a person who has witnessed change in Prairie Village, what do you think about it?
Well, I think change is difficult for all of us. I think that, again, there's good parts and bad parts with change. I, again, like to see the redevelopment that's happening in our city. I think many of the houses that have been built are absolutely beautiful, and they're a welcome addition to our neighborhoods. I think there are some that, you know, maybe don't fit quite as well as others. But again, that's just my personal taste. And the same thing with the retailers. Some of the new retailers that have come in, I'm very excited about. And, you know, maybe some of them not so excited about. But that, I think that's just personal opinion.
And that's change.
Like, that's
some
change.
Of it's going to be good,
that's,
and some
bad. That's
just
change. Exactly.
There's also been change in your life. I mean, this juncture in your career where you're stepping down as mayor, this comes after 20 years in Prairie Village politics. You talked about your time with Parks and Rec. But how did you get into this? Because 20 years ago, I understand you were a stay-at-home mom.
Well, I had been working for Hallmark Cards for 14 years, and then I left to stay home for a couple of years, and politics actually found me, similar to Mayor Wilson, who was on earlier. I had never, ever given politics any thought, and I was home one day, and I received a call from one of my neighbors who was a former city councilman, and he said, "Hey, we've got our current council person running again unopposed, and we would like for you to consider to run." And I thought, that is just so odd. I have no idea what a city council person even does. Why would I want to do that? And after giving it some more thought and attending a council meeting, I realized that the job was actually very similar to the one that I had left at Hallmark, which was in marketing. And basically what I did at Hallmark was product development, which was identifying consumer needs and then filling those needs, trying to fill those needs with product. And I discovered that was very similar to what a city council person did. It was identifying what the community needs were and then trying to come up with solutions to meet those needs. And I thought, you know, that would be a great way for me to get out of the house and use my brain and still be involved and still make a difference and yet still be able to be a mom. So that's how I initially got involved.
What was one of the first needs you identified?
One of the first things I identified was code enforcement issues. When I first became a city council person, I had at least 5 residents contact me who had had ongoing code enforcement issues with their neighbors, some for at least 5 years.
What kinds of code enforcement issues?
Oh, people who were operating businesses out of their home. Maybe they were doing auto mechanic things out of their garage and into their front yard, trash, debris that was in yards, roofs that needed to be replaced, peeling paint, things like that. So got involved in what ended up, actually, we ended up with new judges, new prosecutors, new code enforcement officers, and more attention to actually enforcing code enforcement within Prairie Village and getting those cases resolved.
When you think about the Prairie Village that you look at now as you leave office as mayor, but not just mayor, when you leave 20 years of service to Prairie Village, what do you think is the biggest change? Like, from your standpoint, I've brought up what I think are the big changes, but what do you see as the biggest change?
Oh my gosh, there are so many positive changes over the years. you know, one of my favorite parts of being involved in local government was going through the village visioning process, which was our comprehensive plan that we did many, many years ago, and coming up with all of these ideas for what Prairie Village could be, what we'd like to see, a Main Street concept going from shopping center to shopping center, additional parks, redeveloping the shopping centers, et cetera, and seeing all of that come to fruition over the years has truly been just incredible.
Well, we'll keep watching a changing Prairie Village, but our time is up today. Laura Wassmer, outgoing mayor of Prairie Village, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Gina.
Laura Wassmer has hammered out an anti-discrimination ordinance. She's worked on guidelines for tearing down old houses and rebuilding new ones. And she's transformed an old country club into a mix of parkland and new housing units in a big collaboration with developers. You can listen back to our conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also hear our conversation from earlier in the hour with the new mayor of Leavenworth, Jermaine Wilson. He is hoping to help former inmates in Leavenworth expunge their criminal records, just like he did. Find both conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow we are talking about slang, and I am excited. We've got an expert on how new terms become mainstream from Merriam-Webster. We'll also have someone who knows about current slang, a young person who will tell me what yeet means. You can stump them both tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.